Do not forsake me, oh my darling, on this our wedding day. Do not forsake me, oh my darling. And I must face that deadly killer. Are I a coward, a craven coward? Are I a coward in my grave? Oh, to be torn twixt love and duty, supposing I lose my fair half beauty. Look at that big hand move along near in high noon. He made a vow while in state's prison, thought it would be my life or his. And I'm not afraid of death, but oh, what will I do if you leave me? Do not forsake me, oh my darling. Made that promise when we wed. Do not forsake me, oh my darling. Although you're grieving, I can't be leaving until I shoot Frank Miller dead. Wait long.
Unusual piece of opening music. Good evening. Welcome to a special message tonight. Jeff Bennett on this second day of March. The edge of darkness. More and more, I believe we were on that edge. We're early into March. I'm freezing my butt off. It's not warming up. The weather's horrible from one end of the country to the other. The political scheme we're living through, and see, it is a scheme, is horrendous. I occasionally share with a particular opening line that I've modified from a book called The Fall of Rome. And retitled it, the phrase, The Fall of America, suggests some cataclysmic event ended the American Empire, which had stretched from Maine to California and Florida to Washington. But at the end, there was no straining at the gates, no barbarian horde that dispatched the empire in one fell swoop. Rather, the empire fell slowly, as a result of challenges from within and without, and changing over the course of hundreds of years until its form was unrecognizable. Unrecognizable. The key word. That is what this nation has become. As I was up quite late last night, unable to sleep, I think I laid down around 8 o'clock, slept for an hour and a half, woke up, could not go back to sleep. I went up and grabbed a little bite to eat, some tea, came home, still couldn't sleep. And I began to prepare and post an article by Charles Dickens last night called Who? We the People. In Charles' opening line of the article, which we're not going to share with you tonight for reasons you'll understand momentarily, Charles states, not everyone sees things as I do. I see things differently. I'm not right or wrong, just different and somewhat unconventional. My view is that we created these issues. We, the people. We let this great republic slip through our fingers. Time allowing, I strongly urge you to go to Federal Observer and read Charles' latest column tonight, entitled Who, We the People. And as I prepared to get ready to do this presentation of Charles Dickens tonight, something came across my desk. Total accident, something that I'd published 4 or 5 years ago. And for some reason, I sat there and read it. And I realized this is what I needed to talk about tonight. This is what I needed to share with all of you tonight. It happens to be about films, Hollywood movies, in a roundabout way. Talks about the classic American Western in terms of an emblem of historic American culture. Since the beginning of the last century, the 20th century, one of the newer art forms and expressions of our culture became cinema. Motion pictures, movies, whatever you want to call it. It was the novelty of live theater and acting captured as moving images in film presented on a screen. And in many respects, like other art forms, film represents what is happening in our culture. At its very finest, it is capable of shining a vivid light on our beliefs, our values, portraying them, dissecting them. And like other art forms, it may be used as an instrument to affect or even shape our outlook and our politics. The first significant commercial film produced and shown in this country was The Great Train Robbery, dated 1903, starred someone named Bronco Billy Anderson. The film was but 12 minutes long. And so American film culture began thus with a Western. And indeed, it is arguable that the unique cinematic contribution made by the American film industry was the Western, according to Elia Kazan, a director. It was from the classic Western that crime dramas and adventure films were spun off. Oh, one could well argue that major American crime movies up through, say, The Untouchables, or even some more recent representations, were Westerns just dressed up with cops and robbers. And what about those magnificent adventure films about space exploration? Star Wars, the Star Trek series. Are they not, in a roundabout way, Westerns transported into the relative infinity of space and time, with our unquenchable desire to explore new frontiers where no man has gone before? It is the Western, and its multiple modern cinematic godchildren that represents so well and encapsulates so aptly the movement of American history, our history, the aspirations, the insatiable curiosity of our citizens, just how we as a people overcame various challenges in building what became the United States of America. The story of conquering frontiers is a symbol for the growth, the evolution of the American nation. Offered graphically and sometimes with violence and the effects of right and wrong actions, the absolute requirement for law and order in any civilized society. And at its best, the chronicle of great persons, some real, some idealized, others made up. By hands, a nation was fashioned. And so we hold those persons up as heroes and as models. And thus, maybe a Davy Crockett, a Wild Bill Hickok, Sam Houston, Buffalo Bill, Jesse James. All real flesh and blood people in our past have vividly emerged from the pages of our history books and have entered our consciousness into our everyday lives. Now, sometimes, as in the case of a Billy the Kid or maybe the Clantons of Old Tombstone, they became iconic representations of the bad guys, of the less savory symbols of our history. But in all cases, in each case, they became reference points that make our history alive, tangible. Some years ago, a publication called The Playlist published a list of what they called the 25 best westerns of all time. It's interesting. To read that list is to understand that as much of Hollywood has moved strongly to the ideological left over the past decades, the Hollywood Western also reflects that movement in the subjects and messages it seeks to portray. And indeed, the fact that since the late 1960s and early 70s, the Western has receded as a major film genre, in itself significant. For the Western, more than other cinematic manifestations, is autobiographical about the growth, the trials, above all, the successes of and pride in the American experience. Since certainly the late 1960s, Vietnam and the great success of cultural Marxism in our society, the role of the Western is a reflection of the triumph of traditional good over evil, of the ever-advancing and intrepid frontiersman triumphing over natural hazards, over the elements and fierce aborigines, has all receded. America no longer celebrates those heroes, if it celebrates heroes at all. It's the vaunted pioneers in civil rights, Susan B. Anthony and Nat Turner, or hitherto unknown feminists who, save for political correctness, should have remained unknown. Such as the now about the retired mayor of Chicago. But right and wrong, black and white are muddied. We live in an age of the anti-hero who were inherited and tried and true standards of morality and moral conduct are not only shunted aside, but they're often ridiculed. What does John Wayne in, for example, The Searchers, or She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, what does it have to tell us in our society now where even the concept of duty and obedience to moral right is largely downplayed and considered unsophisticated by the dominant culture? In one of the last great classic Western epics, a film I've not seen in many years, but I can see it all, Sam Peckinpah's Ride the High Country, filmed in 1962. Joel McRae is asked by his co-star, Randolph Scott, if he doesn't really want more in life than just what appears to Scott to be his drudgery as a lonely, low-paid deputy marshal. Well, McCrae's character, Stephen Judd, responds laconically in one of those immortal lines that epitomizes both the representative and the didactic roles of the American Western. And it's a line that I have never forgotten since the first time I saw that film. All I want is to enter my house justified. That is, I want to fulfill my duty, my God-given duty and appointed role in society, to obey and keep the law, to receive the precious legacy of the culture that I inherited. Perhaps add to it a bit. Maybe pass it on, unsullied, to my children, my grandchildren, my posterity. Is this not the message the classic Western offered us, and as well was inculcated into the imaginations of millions of young boys and girls, as well as older adults during its heyday? Was this not the message of Matt Dillon on Gunsmoke or Ben Cartwright of the Ponderosa? In that incredibly rich John Ford Western, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, also from 1962, after Jimmy Stewart has recounted to the assembled newsmen the long history of how he almost inescapably took the credit for John Wayne's gun down of the infamous bandit Liberty Valance, and how it propelled him to fame, to the United States Senate, and now what has been believed for years was essentially built on a legend, a stunned news reporter replies, "This is the West, sir. When legend becomes fact, you print the legend." And so, America, the America that we have loved and wished to preserve and restore, has been dying a slow death for years, my friends, for lack of not only genuine heroes, but for lack of sometimes shadowy, oftentimes mythical legends. For our society, our culture, is not only built on the quantifiable advances of science and materiality, or on the history of new civil rights laws, or on the growth of the sports and the entertainment industry. Come on, every culture has its legends, its quasi-mythical past that inspires it and adds a certain attractive richness and purpose to its existence. Without the great Norse sagas of Scandinavia, or the legend of King Arthur of Britain, or the story of Pelayo in Spain, something integral, something very real and essential in the history of those entities would be lacking. I remember going to see, I didn't see it in the theater, but I remember watching the film Ride the High Country, one of those indelible and intensely moving experiences that always remains with me. Randolph Scott had a mixed and unusual heritage, as it were. But it doesn't matter. It's not germane to what we're discussing tonight. After watching the film, it was explained to me by my grandfather that the Scott character, who initially had skipped out on Joel McRae's character, but returned to help him fight one last battle with the bad guys led by James Drury, had earned redemption, paid the price for his sin by returning. And McRae, in one of the most memorable death scenes in all of film, had a final conversation with Scott. And Scott told him, "Don't worry, I'll take care of everything. I'll get the gold shipment back into the rightful hands." And McRae replied, "Well, heck, I always knew you would. You just forgot for a while." And shortly thereafter, McRae's character died. Blessed are those who have the opportunity to repay the price for evil in this life. That was the message that that I took away from that scene. In a marvelous film representation, two old cowboys brilliantly and wonderfully illustrated and taught much about duty in life, about the importance of complying with our obligations, and finally about redemption for the sins we have committed. Back then there was dozens of films coming out of Hollywood each year that represented what was noble and right in our history and that served as teaching models as we reach manhood. Oh, come on, we wanted to be with Gene Autry. We thought Matt Dillon the finest lawman ever. We laughed out loud with the lovable Hoss Cartwright and Gabby Hayes. We held up John Wayne as our national hero. Whether on a horse, or out west, or aboard a World War II battle wagon afloat. Tell me who society's heroes are today, and I will tell you what that society values and what our society's future is. But I look back, these classic Westerns, they continue to be popular, although you wouldn't know it from the Academy Awards or the hoopla generated by contemporary Hollywood. I remember a left-leaning film critic remarking in condescending tones some time ago that in all likelihood those much-abused deplorables who ended up voting for Trump were probably the same people who, like old John Wayne Westerns, and wanted to be Roy Rogers when growing up. Yeah, maybe he was right, but for the wrong reasons. For many of the deplorables are people who grow up with the inherited moral consciousness, a sense of right and wrong, essentially a religious sense that had given birth and an admirable vitality to this nation, but which is sorely lacking among so many of our fellow citizens today. Mention John Wayne or Audie Murphy or Clint Eastwood of outlaw Josie Wales fame to a deplorable of a certain age, and you get a smile of acknowledgement and agreement. I don't know an awful lot of liberals who like the film Fort Apache. And yet, to enliven the moral imagination and to also appreciate the legacy of our endangered culture, there's no better and no simpler way than to engage in viewing the best of classic Westerns. So we're going to talk about a few of them here tonight. Yeah, they're all available on DVD. Some are catchable occasionally on TV, the Encore Western channels or whatever. Most of these are pieces that I've seen many, many, many times over. Among the first, we begin to look at the collaboration of director John Ford and John Wayne, very truly unique in cinematic history. And some of their finest films include The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which has to rank near the top of any list of great Westerns. And then there's the Cavalry Trilogy from the late 1940s, Fort Apache, Rio Grande, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. Oh, none of those films are politically correct. I mean, consider the band playing Dixie at the Cavalry Pass by at the end of Rio Grande, or the moving respect given to deceased former Confederate General Private John Smith, a.k.a. Rome Clay, in the film She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. Critics generally consider Stagecoach and The Searchers to be the best Ford-Wayne collaborations. But then again, political correctness and modern egalitarianism find no defenders therein. Rather, obedience to duty, moral courage, loyalty to one's state and family. These are the virtues celebrated and heralded. Of those films, The Searchers would have to be my favorite. The character who John Wayne played in the film, Ethan, was the name that was given to our middle name for our son. The late Professor Mel Bradford once said that the John Wayne vehicle Red River was his favorite. And you can see why. Kind of the story of the post war between the states, Texas, the great legendary cattle drives. But it also unraveled in detail conflicting loyalties, the father and son relationship, the belief in honor and in keeping one's word as a bond of trust. We've mentioned Peckinpah's ride to high country several times here today. By the way, Randolph Scott and Joel McRae were both hardcore conservatives politically, as were the vast majority of Western actors. Right before playing in Ride to High Country, Scott did a series of seven lean Westerns with director Bud Bitcher, beginning with Seven Men From Now, ending with Comanche Station, each recounting the story of a man alone against the elements and against those who would stop him. But always there was duty to be fulfilled, honor to be kept. Many Westerns are, to be correct, Southern Westerns that use the war between the states as an essential backdrop, an integral player in the plot and the action. There were certain films like Jesse James, Tyrone Power, Henry Fonda, and Randolph Scott. The Return of Frank James with Fonda. The Run of the Arrow with Rod Steiger, who I don't think I've ever seen that film. Then there's the true story of Jesse James with Robert Wagner and Jeffrey Hunter. Rebel in Town with John Payne. And a largely unknown but happens to be one of my personal favorites, a film called Rocky Mountain with Errol Flynn, Slim Pickens, Patrice Wymore, who was Flynn's third wife. Interesting film. This was a movie that at least presented the Southern viewpoint, unmarred by modern political correctness, or the cultural Marxist fascination about race that everything must resolve around that subject. Of course, James Garner was well known for his portrayal in television's Maverick series, but he also starred in several underrated odors. Most notably, The Hour of the Gun from 1967, kind of a continuation of the classic gunfight of the O.K. Corral. The film featured Garner, Robert Ryan, Jason Robards as Doc Holliday. And it continued the famous O.K. Corral narrative to its deadly conclusion, but at first ignored by film critics. Over the years, it gained in reputation. Interesting film is as a study as to how Wyatt Earp's character changes over time and through tragedy. Two more John Ford creations fill out this interesting list. They both emphasize a fundamental moral understanding that underlying and undergirding the basis of our culture, there is a religious sensibility. First, there is his 1948 version of Three Godfathers, again with Wayne, Ward Bond, Harry Carey Jr. That's Ford in his famous stock company of dependable and outstanding actors. And this film had its deeply Christian symbolism of penance and redemption. And then there was Wagon Master with Carey and Bond and the young, very young Ben Johnson. A lyrical chronicle of pilgrims searching for that ideal valley, that eventual home where they may set down roots, raise their families under both natural and divine positive law. In so many words, it was not the story of the American experience, of blood and land and rootedness and faith. Was it not that American story? I would suggest so. You see, the reality is, my friends, we look back over all of this. We cannot separate our politics from our culture and our history. The culture of our society reflects in large measure the religious outlook we have and exhibit. As Cardinal John Henry Newman observed more than a century and a half ago, political issues always reflect an essentially religious question at their base. it becomes interesting.
And I must face a man who hates me, or lie a coward, a craven coward, or lie a coward in my grave. Oh, to be torn twixt love and duty, supposing I lose my fair-haired beauty. Look at that big hand move along, near in high noon. He made a vow while in state's prison, vowed it would be my life for his, and I'm not afraid of death, but oh, what will I do if you leave me? Do not forsake me.
Oh, we have more to share with you. Let's go ahead and run that tape now, the one I've set you up with, that five-minute tape. And a little earlier than I expected to, but I think it fits in this particular spot. So, ladies and gentlemen, stay with us. We've got a very special recording I came across this afternoon. It happens to deal with a Western, not a Western that we've discussed here tonight. Let's do it.
Stories are the master teachers. If we pay attention, we can learn a lot from them. One of the good stories comes from the 1952 Western High Noon, a favorite of several U.S. presidents. In High Noon, everybody's sweating. It's Judgment Day.
Behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, and all that do wickedly shall be as...
We think Judgment Day is something for another life, but in fact Judgment Day comes all the time. And when it comes, you're exposed and you're naked. You're seen for who you really are. In High Noon, Judgment Day arrives in the form of deranged outlaw Frank Miller. The town marshal, Will Kane, and some deputies arrested Miller a few years back, and the judge sentenced him to hang. But he was released up north, and now he's coming back, due on the train at High Noon. What's Frank Miller come to judge? The town. Society. In particular, the men. Are there any men? And are there any women who will demand a correct version of manhood? Will Kane, played by Gary Cooper, is the man. When he's married to his pacifist Quaker wife at the beginning of the movie, it's not husband and wife, but
man and wife.
Kane has agreed to hang up his star and move away for a more tranquil domestic life, but that's because Miller was taken care of. When news reaches the town that he's coming back, his friends rush him out of the town and say to get going on his new life and not to worry about Miller. But Kane is a man, and he knows something about his friends back at the town. They say they'll face up to it, but they won't face up to it, and Kane knows it. There's a problem that needs to be confronted, and nobody else is going to do it, and so he'll do it. He's a man. So Kane returns. And people aren't happy he's returned. Nobody is. Especially his wife.
Don't try to be a hero. You don't have to be a hero. Not for me.
I'm not trying to be a hero. If you think I like this, you're crazy.
With Kane out of the picture, there was a hope that Judgment Day could be avoided, and many even preferred Miller to Kane. A man like Kane forces the issue, and many people don't feel comfortable around him. Kane's task should be easy. Miller only has 3 men with him. Kane only needs 12 men out of the hundreds of males in the town to help him. The rest of the movie shows what happens in real time as he sets off to round them up. If you haven't seen this movie, I don't want to ruin it for you. I've left you most of the movie to see what happens next. But I do want to say something about 2 of the characters. Kane's deputy is Harv Pell, played by a young Lloyd Bridges. Of everyone, Harv has a duty to help Kane, but he's bitter and resentful. When it was learned that Kane was moving away, Harv wanted his job as marshal, but the town council passed him up for somebody else, and Harv thinks Kane didn't speak up for him. Watch Harv in this movie. He's important. Kane is his idol, his ideal, but he's not Will Kane. And it's very interesting to see how he acts when he's reminded of it, again and again.
But I'm going to tell you something about you and your friend Kane. You're a good-looking boy. You have big, broad shoulders. But he is a man. It takes more than big, broad shoulders to make a man, Harvey. And you have a long way to go.
That's Helen Ramirez, played by Katie Jurado, who delivers perhaps the best performance of the movie. She's a woman who has experience with the world. You can tell that her life has been filled with both mistakes and successes, and she's learned something from them. And what she's learned is the value of correct manhood. She knows the difference between false manhood and the real thing, and she knows the value of the real thing. She thinks the man is going to die. She knows a lot rides on that.
Cain will be a dead man in half an hour, and nobody is going to do anything about it. And when he dies, this town dies too.
Manhood isn't like womanhood. Womanhood is inherent. We don't debate who's a woman and who's not. Well, not in the way I'm talking about. Manhood is different. It's a status, and it's a fleeting status. It imbues in those who live the principles of manhood and escapes males when they don't. Males don't get to choose if they're men. It's determined by their actions on Judgment Day. Judgment Day will come, and when it arrives, one thing it will ask is, where are the men? If nobody's there to respond, the town dies.
And I must face that deadly killer. Am I a coward? A craven coward? Am I a coward?
Unbelievable. I never heard this before. I came across this today, and it gave me even greater emphasis as to why I wanted to share this commentary with you today. So many of you are going to be quite familiar with the films that we've discussed. Certainly the actors. We've grown up with them. We've watched them pass. There's few, if any, of them still alive. I don't think any of those that we've mentioned are still alive, other than in film, on the screen. It is profound to watch how this nation has died, not because of film, but in spite thereof. Classic Westerns, as an example, offer insight into who we have been as a people. Our hopes, our aspirations, our trials, our tragedies, but also our triumphs. They offer in film stories of legendary heroes, heroic events. They hold up honor and duty as admirable benchmarks. They emphasize the importance of family and of place. And they have revealed the necessity of a grounded religious faith in the pursuit of our ideals. So all that we've tolerated these last 6-7 years or thereabouts regarding this making America great again stuff, we all must understand that such efforts involve a panoply of activities on different levels. Not just about how we vote, but also within our families, the church, the schools, what we do for entertainment. And amongst the ways to accomplish this is in the place of the tawdry and garish culture that parades before us, to gather in family and view a classic John Wayne or John Ford film or something with one of those fine Westerners of yesteryear, a Joel McRae, a Randolph Scott, or maybe an Audie Murphy. That's interesting. I've seen few Audie Murphy films that I ever liked. But that didn't make him a bad person. Look at the man's history. Understand, my friends, our heritage, those principles we hold most dear, will live, but only if we let them live first within us, and if we pass them on unsullied to our children, our grandchildren. You see, the culture we have received from our ancestors in the great legends and wonderful stories brought to the silver screen, they all nourish the moral imagination, help repair the disintegrative diseases of the modern mind. All I want is to enter my house justified, to do my duty, fulfill my purpose before God, my family, my fellow men, and indeed, my friends, doing those things will make America great again. And if we're not prepared to fight those battles, then it's over. It is the reality of the day. Simply the reality of the day. Now, at some point in time when I revamped Federal Observer, I developed a category called Sunset Boulevard. Now, that's an old film with Gloria Swanson and William Holden. But that was not my purpose. My purpose was to publish articles that deal with film, but deal with it in a manner that of how we live, how we are conducting ourselves. The category archives for Sunset Boulevard describe an old film title. And I state that there's times we'll post a column about a movie, a new one, or an old title. However, there are times when the story matches the dark times we are living in today. And that's the basis of our commentary for tonight. What's interesting is the piece that was published prior to that, I believe, maybe later than that, July of 2018. Unbelievably powerful. Just the title alone is enough to wake you and shake you. It's entitled Socialism, Like Dracula, Rises Again from the Grave. No matter what the reboot or rebrand may imply, Dracula is still a monster, and democratic socialism is still tyranny. I've not published things like this for a while, because, to be honest with you, I've not come across anything of this caliber worth publishing. I wrote a piece, or I published a piece called The Authenticity of Clint Eastwood's Gran Torino. Published them back in December of 2018. Kind of told you the history as to how I even got into going to see that movie. Unreal. Perversion of the Days. Story about the film Eyes Wide Shut, which just about was the end of the marriage of Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise. But there's far more to it. Perversion. Jeffrey Epstein. Interesting stuff. Other pieces that we published, Alfred Hitchcock's 39 Steps. The question was it a coded message? It's quite a film, by the way. We got a piece about Metropolis, which many of you know is the name of one of our websites, metropolis.cafe. Metropolis is a remnant from the late 1920s. Coming to the light once again, more complete way. Industrial environment, modern work of change, concern for social justice. Questions about technology are just as intense as they were when the film premiered. Some of these articles are well worth looking at just for these reasons. article that I think I wrote called Get Off My Lawn. Yeah, I got too much time to fill. Piece that I published in this segment, but also without apology, called Get Off My Lawn. Interesting piece. I guess in many respects it shows how things have changed in the world, in this country, over the years. It's quite profound. Saw a movie back in 09. At that point, I felt like the main character in the film. Walter was a veteran of the Korean War, just buried his wife of 45 years, had no relationship with his two grown married sons, didn't know his grandchildren, all of whom are waiting for him to croak so they can get what's theirs. He hated zipperheads, gooks, slopes, Buddha heads. Had no tolerance for most ethnic peoples, including three spooks with whom he had an altercation, and while defending his next-door neighbor, a gook. I didn't sleep well the night that I saw this film. But the year was 1972. Life was simpler for my wife and I. Back then, we lived in a small third-story walk-up at the far northern border of Chicago, Rogers Park, just before the bend that took us past Calvary Cemetery leading into Evanston. Our bedroom window overlooked the parking lot of the next complex with a view of a beach, the shore of Lake Michigan. Each weekend we'd go down to the beach. The Hare Krishnas would always had a pot of free veggie stew to offer. They'd taken over a massive old apartment building called the Yacht Club, which was at the south end of the beach. Later that year, we bought our first home. Tricky Dick was still in the White House in the midst of his reelection campaign. Watergate was simply a hotel in Washington, D.C. Richard J. Daley still ran the city that worked. But I believe that was the year that, upon being questioned by a reporter about an insurance contract being awarded by the city to his son's firm, Daley calmly stated what father wouldn't try to help his son, whereupon his honor turned his backside to the press and showed a piece of mistletoe hanging from his belt. The time that I wrote this particular article, his punk kid was the mayor. The city no longer worked. Politics of Chicago still makes kings of lesser personages. 1972, I drove a Super Beetle and the Grand Torino had been given a facelift in Detroit. So Walter Kowalski, retired Ford assemblyman, had become an angry old man. Disillusioned by the Catholic Church, the loss of his wife, the fact that his son drives a Jap car. Killed mercilessly in Korea and outwardly doesn't seem affected, but as the film progresses, we find that it bothers him more and more than he realized. He tells his new young zipperhead friend that you don't want to know what it's like to kill. He's the last holdout in a neighborhood that was once populated with other factory workers from the plant. People who, in absence, he still cusses out for having sold out to the gooks. The homes of the neighborhood are in a sad state of disrepair, and the spicks and the Buddha heads are at war. And when the gangs come onto his property, at the point of a gun, they're told, get off my lawn. Now, most of you have seen the film. I'm not going to share the rest of it with you because it's too powerful. And for some, it's got a surprise ending. But suffice it to say, it was, in my opinion, one of the finest films of Eastwood's career. And although the critics had billed it as vintage Eastwood, it's not. It was mature Eastwood in a play, in a way, you know, in a way that you don't expect. Eastwood has grown as a filmmaker, both behind the camera as an actor. He's become, in many respects, the conscience of our times. Because this film depicted more than others in recent times the duopolistic prejudice of both Walt and his Hwang neighbors. In an early scene, while looking in disdain at an old woman sitting on her porch, Walt mumbles to himself his apparent dissatisfaction of his zipperhead neighbors. He spits his chew on the ground. The grandmother of Hwang family sits on the porch looking back at him and with equal disdain, speaking in her native tongue, asks him, why don't you get out of the neighborhood? And then spits an even bigger wad of chew. Neither one trusts or cares for the other. We laugh as we watch the scene, but I suspect the laughter to be one of discomfort because we all know the feeling too well. But like Kowalski, I've aged into anger. I'm angry that a nation no longer honors our war veterans, instead leaving them to die slow, painful deaths, whether from physical maladies or mental or emotional stress. All the time sending them to fight in other people's wars. I'm angry that I fought in a war that I now know was not fought to stop communism in its tracks, but to further the interests of big business and the global cabal. I'm angry that American businesses have been extended tax credits in order to move manufacturing plants overseas while employing cheap labor and putting Americans out of work. You see, Walt's beloved Gran Torino would today be built within Mexico. I'm angry that our borders have remained unguarded, open to all comers, whether spick, wetback, mick, wop, zipperhead, chink, gook, slopehead, or whatever. For each of these peoples, their histories and heritage is long and storied, and in all cases far older than that of America. I believe in one's desire to migrate to the United States, but in the proper fashion, not by breaking and entering through the back door, coming here with the demands in which many cases would be answered at the point of a gun in their own lands. I'm angry that many of the invaders coming to America, albeit looking to improve their lives, are willing to work for next to nothing, undercutting what constitutes a livable wage for those Americans who have been displaced in the workforce. Ah, oh, solo mio, my friends. Because although angry at the ongoing invasion, unlike Walter, I have a respect for those who come to this country and work hard to truly better their lives. In many cases, bringing with them their customs, their beliefs, like Kowalski's neighbors, Tao and Sue, and their extended families. I had respect for those who not only through work ethic, but through tenacity, focused their energy on education, all for the betterment of a family as a whole. And for the most part, we spoiled angry Americans to become an operatic society with a me attitude towards life. And yet I understand the anger, the self-pity, the sense that something isn't right, that much, so much has been taken away from us. I once heard a statement in a film, of course, that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. In that same sense, there are those who realize that much of our freedom has been stripped from America today through executive order and legislation such as the Patriot Act. And yet many of those entering the United States legally or otherwise find greater degrees of freedom here than in their own lands. Hence, one man's slavery is another man's freedom. You see, aliens and immigrants seem to have greater freedom in America today than those of us who were born here, or those who became citizens in a legal and proper manner. And through programs like Affirmative Action and No Child Left Behind, which was really designed to assist the children of illegal aliens, and the forced diversity training within our schools, in addition to the preferential financial arrangements given to immigrants of all flavors, Americans are taking it in the shorts, folks. And the illegals are still invading. And like the neighbors in the film, the invaders take no pride in where they live. Their homes, their properties are allowed to decline into a state of disrepair. So do you really believe that Moses will deliver us into prosperity? Let those people go, or more specifically, send them home. You're goddamn right I'm angry. Get off my lawn. It's a piece I was not prepared to share with you tonight, but I guess to some degree it expands out just exactly what the hell's wrong in this country. Did Western movies resolve the issues? Of course not. They're not going to. But the commentary about the Western film was a very interesting one. It tells us the difference in the way we were, to pay homage to an old song by Barbara Streisand. Yeah, I'm angry. What are we going to do about it as a people? Nothing? Are we going to just sit back? I'm afraid the average American is going to do exactly that. Sit back and not do a damn thing. Because they can't. They're too tired. They're too worn out. They're too overwhelmed. They'd rather just go to a movie. Sit home. Turn on the TV. I don't know. I don't know the answers anymore. But I am angry and I'm worn out. And we're reaching the end of our program tonight. I thank Maggie Rose for listening in tonight and recording this commentary. I thank you for being with us. Lord willing, I'll be back with you on Tuesday. But I'm angry and I'm worn out and I'm pissed off. But we'll do our best to be here. We're closing with a similar piece of music to the one we opened with because it fits. Stay with us, folks. See you then.
Do not forsake me, oh my darling. On this our wedding day, do not forsake me, oh my darling. Wait, wait along. I do not know what fate awaits me. I only know I must be brave, and I must face a man who hates me. Or lie a coward, a craven coward. Or lie a coward in my grave. Oh, to be torn twixt love and duty. Supposing I lose my fair-haired beauty. Look at that big hand move along near in high noon. He made a vow while in state's prison, vowed it would be my life for his, and I'm not afraid of death, but oh, what will I do if you leave me? Do not forsake me, oh my darling. You made that promise as a bride. Do not forsake me, oh my darling. Although you're grieving, don't think of leaving. Now that I need you by my side, wait along, wait along, wait along, wait along.
Have you been looking for a trusted long-term storable food company? We have a solution for you. Simply Clean Foods is dedicated to providing the best quality food you can buy next to fresh from a farmer's market. Our line of resealable fruits, vegetables, and meats are suitable for everyday use, and you won't have to worry about throwing away valuable groceries ever again. Our food is completely GMO-free, and our stringent quality controls, plus testing for heavy metals, makes us unique in the storable foods market. Simply Clean Foods' primary focus is to bring clean food to people all around the world and change the way we look at freeze-dried food in our daily cooking. When you purchase from Simply Clean Foods, not only will you be receiving high-quality food, but you will also be supporting veterans in need across the country and those who are affected by natural disasters.
Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on long-term food storage in the rotating sponsors banners to support RBN.
Simply Clean Foods. Do it today.
You're listening to Real Talk Radio. Only on the Republic Broadcasting Network.